Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Steps Decision, Colorado Department of State versus Baca and Chiafalo versus Washington. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Derek T. Muller, a professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Professor Muller, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a long-awaited decision about faceless electors from the 2016 presidential election. You know, as you may know, when we vote for the president of the United States, we are not actually voting directly for the president in early November. We are voting for a slate of electors who are pledged, usually, to support that presidential candidate. And the Electoral College convenes in late December to cast the formal votes for the president of the United States. And for a long period of time now, really since after the election of George Washington, we've expected that electors sort of align with a particular candidate or a particular party. They've cast a vote consistent with that expectation of the voters. And there have been occasional instances where what we describe as faceless electors, electors who vote in a way contrary to those expectations or the desires of the voters. But they've rarely exercise this sort of independent judgment that maybe the framers, or at least some of the framers, had anticipated they would exercise. So we can fast forward to the 2016 presidential election, where after it becomes apparent that Donald Trump is the candidate who wins the most electoral votes after Election Day, there's some movement among some presidential electors to suggest, well, maybe we could vote for somebody else, or we could get a block of voters who would maybe support a different candidate. And if so, maybe we can either deny Donald Trump the majority of the presidential electors, in which case someone else would win the election, or else at the very least the election could be sent to the House of Representatives so that they could choose a different candidate. And so there were a number of these efforts throughout the country in different states, and two of them sort of came at issue here. One, out of Washington state, there were four electors who cast votes for candidates other than Hillary Clinton, whom won the popular vote in the state. And three of those electors voted for Colin Powell for president and various candidates for vice president. They were each fined under Washington state law $1,000 for breaching sort of their pledge. And when they challenged those fines through state court, the Washington State Supreme Court affirmed the fines, saying that they didn't have sort of unfettered discretion. The state had the power to fine them in the event that they chose to vote for someone other than the candidate they were pledged to support. So that was the Washington state sort of side of things in the case called Chiafalo versus Washington. And then there was a second case that came out of Colorado called Baca, Colorado Department of State versus Baca, where Michael Baca was an elector who, again, pledged to support Hillary Clinton, but he showed up at the meeting of the Electoral College and attempted to vote for John Kasich for president instead of Hillary Clinton. And when he attempted to do so, he was deemed to have vacated his office. He was then replaced by the electors with another elector who voted for Hillary Clinton, and then those votes were sent along to Congress, which counted those votes. So when Baca challenged his replacement, it went up through the district court in Colorado, and the Tenth Circuit found that Colorado's law was unconstitutional, that Colorado could not enforce this requirement that electors have the discretion to be able to vote for whomever they desire, and the state can't replace him. So there was a sort of difference in opinion between the Washington State Supreme Court and the Tenth Circuit, and that's when it came to the Supreme Court in these pair of cases. So there's a little bit of a quirk that happened. These cases were originally consolidated to be heard together, but Justice Sotomayor later in the process realized that she had a personal friendship with one of the parties in the Colorado case, so she was dropped out of that case. And so all nine justices heard Schaffalo, and then only eight formally heard Baca. So the Supreme Court issued its decision today, and the approach it took was one that a lot of people had speculated, which is that the principal opinion in Schaffalo, which involves all nine justices, was sort of one that was issued, and then there was a very brief per curiam opinion in Baca with Justice Sotomayor recused, saying, go back and see Schaffalo for the same reasoning. So for the most part, these cases are decided together, except for this sort of one technical distinction that happened here. So in Schaffalo, the decision of the court is unanimous, or at least the result is unanimous. Eight justices joined in Justice Kagan's majority opinion, and Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion, concurring in the judgment, which Justice Gorsuch joined in part. But all nine justices agreed that states do have the power to fine electors who cast votes contrary to the expectations of the voters, and they do have the power to replace faithless electors, too. So Justice Kagan's opinion really heavily relies first on a case called Ray versus Blair, which was a 1952 decision out of Alabama involving whether states could even create this pledge in the first place. Alabama had had a rogue elector, if you will, in 1948, and they wanted to try to provide some extra certainty. And they said, well, let's require electors to take this pledge. There was no enforcement mechanism in place, just sort of a requirement that you take the pledge. And the court there said, you know, for a long time, electors have been sort of exercising not their independent judgment, but essentially acting on behalf of the voters who have selected them to essentially act as their agents. And so requiring them to a pledge is something that the Constitution doesn't forbid states from doing. So states could require electors to take a pledge. Now, the enforceability of that pledge was something that was in dispute until this case, and the court sort of, again, relies on this long-standing practices kind of understanding that really electors have been very consistently faithful in terms of the votes they cast. When we think about long-standing, if you will, liquidation of precedent over an extended period of time, the court relies on things like the resets appointments challenges and NLRB versus Noel Canning points out, you know, these are sort of longstanding expectations in our constitutional structure. And the fact that we've for a long time had electors who are expected to vote in a particular way, Ray versus Blair says we can require them to take a pledge. Now in Schiaffalo, it says, you know, states can fine them or states can replace them in the event that they choose to do something else. And the court's majority opinion is really deferential to the states because there's a line Justice Kagan uses where she says the Constitution is bare bones about electors, right? And if the Constitution doesn't have very much, it has this sort of brief mention of appointment and process and how we count votes and how we transmit lists to Congress. Without much else there, the Constitution is fairly silent, and if that's the case for the majority, that means broad discretion given to the states to control the manner of appointing presidential electors. That can include fining faithless electors or replacing them. And the electors' argument when they raise this claim is say, look, the Constitution includes these phrases like elector and ballot and vote, and when you see words like this in the Constitution, these are words that suggest a kind of independent choice, right? The opportunity to exercise judgment. Ballots are supposed to be private or secret. They're written down as opposed to an oral vote. Votes are supposed to be something that you have the decision to choose among things, right? So this language the electors had argued, Schaffalo and Baca said, this gives us sort of deference to make the decisions we want. But Justice Kagan was sort of, less impressed with this line of reasoning, saying, look, they don't always mean independent choice. If a person says, I always vote the way my pastor or my union boss or my spouse tells me to, and I just always do that. Yeah, I guess I'm not really exercising independent judgment anymore, but I'm still voting. I'm still casting a ballot in these cases, right? So the court was not as persuaded that these words in the Constitution actually required independent choice. And this was confirmed, she pointed out, by the 12th Amendment. So in the original Constitution, the electors were supposed to meet and they were supposed to vote for two candidates. Whoever got the most votes became president. Whoever got the second most votes became vice president. And this worked well when everyone wanted George Washington as president. And then there were a bunch of sort of scattered votes elsewhere. But the system broke down in a couple of ways. And in 1796, where, you know, John Adams had his own sort of vice presidential candidate, they were running kind of as a ticket. But they realize your electors can't all vote for the same two people or else it's a tie and the election gets sent to the House. But then it turns out that too many people voted for someone as their second choice other than Adams' preferred vice presidential candidate. And so Adams' enemy, Thomas Jefferson, is the runner-up and becomes the vice president in that 1796 election. And then in 1800... everyone votes for Thomas Jefferson, or all the Jeffersonians vote for Thomas Jefferson for president and Aaron Burr for vice president. They tie and it goes to the House of Representatives, where they have to go to 36, you know, attempts to vote to figure out whether or not to figure out who the winner is going to be before it gets to be Jefferson. So these are two complicated systems and processes, but they also sort of suggest at this point, Justice Kagan points out, there's an expectation that electors are going to vote for the party candidate. And so when the 12th Amendment is enacted in 1804, to allow candidates to or electors to vote for a president and a separate vice president on distinct ballots, you know, there's this implication within there that they're also going to be expected to sort of follow through with the decision making processes in terms of what a candidate wants or what the popular vote has expected or demanded. Right. So the amendment advanced this understanding, she explained, from the nation's first election. So whatever the Federalist Papers might have thought about the Electoral College, you know, the 12th Amendment has updated and sort of altered the expectations at that point. And the electors had a challenge to say, you know, Congress has counted faithless electors before. We can point to all these faithless electors. And on the one hand, Justice Kagan says, well, yeah, they have. But there are instances where, you know, a candidate dies and they vote for somebody else. And so a lot of these aren't necessarily what we might describe as faithless. But she also says, you know, the fact that Congress has deferred to state decisions on faithless electors doesn't mean that we have to reject the fact that a state has penalized electors. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If Congress can count faithless electors, maybe Congress can also choose to reject the votes of faithless electors when the state has done so. And there are a couple of footnotes in my mind that were of note also in the opinion. So one is the state emphasizes, look, when you appoint, or the court says when the state appoints electors, it has to be consistent with other provisions of the Constitution. So there are still some limits on what they can do. They can't violate equal protection, for instance. So if a state were to, you know, have a racially exclusionary elector selection system, that would probably run afoul of the Constitution. And another is that if states appoint a condition on appointments that impose new requirements on presidential candidates, the condition may conflict with the Presidential Qualifications Clause. And this is a suggestion that comes out of a case involving term limits in the 1990s for Congress, an open question about whether or not states can add qualifications to presidential candidates, including, in recent years, people have talked about requiring candidates to disclose their tax returns as a condition of appearing on the ballot. And the suggestion here from the court in this footnote is that it would call into question such laws that would add qualifications to candidates seeking the office of president. So that's one interesting footnote. Another was, footnote 8 of the opinion, that the court notes, well, the electors point out, what happens if a candidate dies between Election Day and the meeting of the Electoral College? Don't states have to exercise independent judgment? And some states actually have an express proviso that allows for electors to exercise their independent judgment if the candidate dies. You know, Justice Kagan points out, this is not before us. We doubt states would necessarily enforce it. Who knows what will happen? You know, in my view, there's an additional question sort of about the 20th Amendment, because we sort of now might presume that even if you were to vote for an ineligible president or a dead president by Inauguration Day, the vice president becomes president. So there's sort of this provision to sort of recognize that death can be its own sort of interesting wrinkle to consider when it comes to presidential electors. But, you know, again, it was something that the court didn't have to consider today. And then Justice Thomas, so he wrote a separate opinion concurring in the judgment. And part one of his opinion sort of emphasized, look, the court's not really sort of being consistent with how it approaches sort of constitutional text or the mechanism of the state. But really, he focuses also in an opinion joined by Justice Gorsuch in part two of the opinion about the 10th Amendment. And this is an argument that he had raised, and he lost this case in 1995 called Term Limits versus Thornton. And he wrote an opinion on behalf of four justices saying, if the Constitution doesn't prohibit states from doing things, then the 10th Amendment reserves those decisions to the state. And in the 90s, he said that means that states have the power to add qualifications or at least add a term limit requirement to members of Congress. And here again, he emphasizes the 10th Amendment, although not with four justices in dissent, just Justice Gorsuch joining him to say, you know, the Constitution is really silent in terms of the power to control elections. And as opposed to the majority, which just says this silence means states have power, we should be looking instead to the 10th Amendment. And if it's the 10th Amendment, the 10th Amendment means the states have this reserved power. So when we're thinking about where the state's authority comes from, it doesn't come from longstanding practices or sort of a broad consensus of historical understanding. It really ought to come out of the 10th Amendment's power. But again, that decision, you know, only joined by Justice Gorsuch, it received a little bit of attention at oral argument. I was intrigued to see if Justice Kavanaugh, for instance, was going to join that, but he didn't. In short, so all nine justices agreed with the outcome. States can fine faithless electors. They can replace faithless electors. So what that means for today is, you know, all of the existing laws on the books, which, you know, there's a variety of laws on the books. Some laws, you know, require a pledge with no enforcement. Some states have an enforcement mechanism, and a number of states don't have any sort of rule at all. You know, it's just kind of states can, or electors can exercise their independent judgment. And if they do so, there's no penalty, no fine, nothing like that. What I anticipate, so we should expect the status quo, if you will, for the 2020 election. Faithless electors will have a much more difficult time in those jurisdictions where there is a penalty mechanism in place. You know, so it would be difficult to rebel if that's like in 2016. But more to the point, I would anticipate maybe not so many by 2020 because, you know, we've got a closing window by November, but certainly by the 2024 election, I expect state legislatures to begin instituting new statutes in earnest to control and bind presidential electors. I think the activities of 2016 highlighted this sort of weakness in the system for many. Voters don't expect when they vote for Hillary Clinton, they don't expect their elector to then show up on the meeting of the Electoral College and vote for Colin Powell or John Kasich, right? So my anticipation is states will begin to enact new statutes that will bind presidential elector discretion, probably more that will replace them rather than just fine them. But, you know, that remains an open question, but certainly a green light to legislatures to sort of alter how their presidential electors are chosen. With that, I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Perfect. Let's go to audience questions. We'll now go to the first question.
So question, in 2020, what happens in those states that don't have legislation yet and people rebel and vote for somebody other than Biden or President Trump?
Yeah, well, historically, what's happened in other times? Nothing. So, electors... again, for a long part of America's history, there have not been laws binding electors, and there have been instances of faithless electors. Now, again, they're infrequent, and they've been historically infrequent. That's a reason why maybe a lot of states haven't done so. But, you know, in some recent examples, in 2000, for instance, one D.C. elector just abstained from voting because she was protesting the fact that protesting D.C.'s statehood issue. In 2004, an elector miswrote the name John Edwards in for president instead of John Kerry out of Minnesota. And so there are these instances where these things happen, right? And in 2016, there were no laws in the books in Texas. There were two electors who didn't vote for Donald Trump. They voted for someone else. So these have happened before. And if it happens, then it goes to Congress. If someone in Congress wants to fight about it, they can. But the presumption is if the state law doesn't regulate it or prohibit it, then the electors can kind of exercise their independent judgment and do what they want. So now one reason that this historically hasn't been a problem is because most of the time the electoral college margins are very wide. So even if there's one or two faithless electors, no one particularly cares too much in a given moment. In 2016, it was the first time where there was a real concerted effort to get electors around the country to kind of join together and do something. Now, it didn't really work because, again, these were mostly Clinton electors that defected. They were on the losing side, and they weren't voting for the same person. They were voting, Powell or Kasich or whoever it might be. So I think the question is, in 2020, if there's going to be this push, if the electoral college margin is very close, is there going to be a push in states that don't have these, statutes in place to try to replicate what happened in 2016? Now, it would require a much closer margin. But otherwise, if there's no legislation on the books, electors can do what they want, and then it's sort of up to Congress to decide whether or not to count them. And in 1968, when they gathered to decide about a faithless elector in North Carolina who didn't want to vote for Nixon and voted for someone else, Congress looked at it and said, there's no law on the books, nothing in the Constitution that says that we're going to count the votes. And I would expect that to happen in 2020 as well.
Perfect. Let's go to the next question. Caller from Erie
Code. It's Mike Stern. I have a question. It's maybe a little bit out of left field, but under Article 5, there are two types of conventions provided for: the convention for proposing amendments and then conventions for ratifying constitutional amendments. A number of states have passed laws that purport to bind delegates to such conventions, particularly the proposing convention, which has never actually occurred, but a number of states have passed laws that basically say, if we're going to limit the discretion of delegates to an Article 5 convention as to what they can vote for. So if a state applies for a particular type of amendment, a balanced budget amendment, their delegates would only be allowed to vote for such an amendment. Do you think this decision says anything about the constitutionality of such laws?
Mike, great question. And really interesting.
Like I
prospect.
Said, out of left field.
No, it's great. Well, so first, obviously, if you have the robust view of the 10th Amendment, right, so you've got at least a couple justices on board with that, and maybe others would get on board if they didn't feel like it was an elections clause kind of issue, So I think there's the 10th Amendment sort of reasoning that could resonate and, again, persuade maybe more justices. It's interesting because we haven't, we historically haven't had situations where we've been, calling conventions to sort of where we need to bind those, delegates to do certain acts. So in some ways, it's tough to bring in the historical analog from the majority opinion here, which sort of relies on this fact that every 4 years these electors all show up and they're all kind of expected to do the same thing and they all kind of follow in suit and they sort of do what's necessary. So it's an interesting, but at the same time, Justice Kagan's point that the Constitution is very bare bones about this. And in a bare bones structure, if we can continue the baseball metaphor, right, maybe tie goes to the runner, right, or tie goes to the state to say, in a bare bones structure, which this seems to be, right, Article 5 is pretty minimal in terms of what the conditions are to place upon electors, whether it's freewheeling or how the states are supposed to do it in terms of their applications. And so if you're given sort of that sort of free form, open-ended provision of Article 5, then it would suggest that, maybe states could delegate. So I think that portion of the majority's opinion is probably the most persuasive to thinking about the constitutionality of binding delegates to a convention, to say, there's very little provision given in Article 5 and given that bare bones structure and nothing that we think would otherwise prohibit the states from doing so, like a prohibition on adding candidate qualifications for president or Congress as the court has construed, without sort of that sort of express proviso, we think that this is something that that the states are empowered to do. And maybe now, sort of walking back my earlier point, the fact that we haven't been, you know, holding conventions for extended periods of time and sending delegates there, the states have expected that they have this power, right? They've been acting as if they have it. And when they pass these sort of, you know, convention proposals, they purport to bind the delegates, and there's this expectation. So maybe that's a factor that also cuts in favor slightly of the historical narrative too. But it's a great question, and one now I'm gonna noodle over.
Great. Thanks very much.
Perfect. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Bob Popper. I have a question about the National Popular Vote Compact, which in effect requires electors to vote for whoever received the national popular vote largest total. I mean, and you could look at it as requiring faithless electors on the one hand. On the other hand, if states can, you know, put down any requirements they want, how does this decision affect the National Popular Vote Compact when, if it ever gets enough, you know, signers, it's going to come before the court?
Sure. No, it's a great question. So in my view, this doesn't dramatically alter how we view the National Popular Vote Compact proposal. So on the one hand, it makes it a more reliable national popular vote winner, right? That is, if states combine their electors to choose, you know, to say, you know, whoever wins the statewide popular vote, those are the electors we're choosing, that slate of electors, and you electors have to follow through with your promise. They could also do the same thing and say, well, whoever wins the nationwide popular vote, we're choosing that slate of electors, and those electors have to follow through with the promise to vote for this particular candidate. So in a way, it makes it more reliable. You're going to have fewer faithless electors, if you will, and therefore you're going to have a more reliable national popular vote winner if the compact takes effect. At the same time, you know, I go back to the court's sort of footnote 4 here, where it says, listen, other provisions of the Constitution do, you know, control and bind what states do. They can't add qualifications to candidates. They can't violate the Equal Protection Clause. So there are a few, you know, other provisions of the Constitution at play here. One that I've talked about has been the Compact Clause, that I think this is an interstate compact that would require congressional consent. But even in the event there is congressional consent, how do you handle it? So others have raised equal protection challenges to how you count votes in 50 different states when they're all running with different rules about voter eligibility and vote counting standards and recount standards. There have been challenges to say that each state shall appoint, in Article 2, a number of electors, and that the notion is the state is no longer doing the appointment if it's deferring to some other body, which is the national popular vote winner. So there are some of these sort of structural claims that apply. So I think in the event the national popular vote passes, there is going to be sort of, again, a little bit more reliability on the faithless elector side. But at the same time, I don't think it fundamentally alters the kinds of legal challenges that will inevitably be brought to contest. Whether or not it's a viable, legitimate sort of thing within our constitutional framework.
Let's go to the next question. We have one caller in the queue.
Yes. So my question was in regards to if we have all the electors vote with what the popular vote is said to be, would that defeat the purpose of having the republic? And wouldn't it make sense to have a pure democracy in that sense?
No, it's an interesting question to think about what the Electoral College is still doing at that point, right? So in my view, I think the Electoral College still functions to first disperse our elections on a state-by-state basis, right? So the elections are still administered, you know, among the 50 states in D.C. Again, different states have different voting standards, different voter qualifications, different candidates appear on the ballot. You know, ex-felons can vote in some states, incarcerated felons can vote in some states. You know, it's sort of a wide spectrum in some ways. You know, less today maybe than it was 200 years ago, but certainly some. So it disperses that. It also, because the Electoral College is allocated on the basis of Senate and House representation, it ensures that every state gets sort of a minimal say. So small states get some minimal say, and even though, you know, Wyoming and Vermont might proportionately have a much smaller population than California, they get a little bit more of a boost in the Electoral College because they each get two senators, and that gives them somewhat of a boost relative to California. And that's, again, part of our sort of federalist structure where we've sort of deferred to the states and sort of ensure that the states as states have some of this representation. So I think there's still some place to think about how the Electoral College functions and how sort of the way it operates in terms of allocating power among the states still works. But you're right. One element is thinking about the presidential electors who no longer sort of serve as this independent function where they show up and just vote for somebody. But to the extent that they haven't been really doing that since maybe the founding. I mean, at the founding, I guess everyone expected the electors to all vote for George Washington. But even by 1796, the electors were all sort of party loyalists voting for one person or another with sort of very rare exceptions. So while we're formally maybe thinking about a different structure to presidential elections, in practice, I don't know that it really makes much of a difference today than it was, at the time of the 12th Amendment.
Looks like the caller queue is wide open. Professor, while I have the opportunity, I know you said that you didn't foresee this decision having significant impact in the upcoming election, but have you heard any rumblings from state legislatures about trying to pass new regulations in light of this decision?
Not in the last couple hours, but I will say, I mean, the Uniform Law Commission has, about 10 years ago developed a rule, and they were trying to be very sort of conscious of what Ray versus Blair required. They wrote an amicus brief sort of, supporting the states in this case. There was an amicus brief on behalf of 47 states. I think D.C. also joined it. I think only three states didn't join the brief, all saying that, states should have this power. And this includes the states that don't have rules on their books right now, right? So I think it's going to be an interesting conversation in state legislatures about what they want to do. I imagine a number of states will immediately, enact rules saying, well, if we're good to go on this and there's no question about it, and this is sort of a loose end that we don't want, we'll pass a statute. At the same time, the discussions do look a little different. I had a conversation with a legislator in Washington State after this decision who said, look, one of the reasons we like having a fine rather than replacing the elector is we want you to be able to exercise your independent judgment if you really want to. But if you really want to, there's going to be a penalty that attaches to it. And so you have to think that you're really doing it for a purpose and for a reason and give some materiality to that. So maybe some states are going to come to kind of compromise decisions like that one in Washington. Now, Washington's repealed that statute. So it's also like its own sort of thing. But my anticipation is a lot of states don't like this kind of uncertainty. They want higher degrees of certainty. They like the fact now that when they print the names on the ballot, it's going to be someone who's going to support that particular candidate. And I think it's this doesn't have a partisan valence, right? If you vote for Biden, you want your electors to vote for Biden, and if you vote for Trump, you want your electors to vote for Trump, right? So in legislatures, whether it's controlled by Republicans or Democrats, they both kind of want the same thing. They want, if their candidate wins, they want their electors to vote for the winner. And so I think that's also an unusual, area of consensus for state legislatures, that while sometimes election laws have a high sort of partisan valence concern, here you don't really have that. Here you really have sort of the interests of both major parties aligned, and I would anticipate that makes it easier to enact legislation. And given that you do have sort of a ready-made Uniform Law Commission statute, I imagine it'll be something that will be in the minds of legislatures. Now, it's off term for a lot of legislatures right now, not only summer, but, for part-time legislatures, they're often off. So that's why I think it's going to be a little bit less for 2020. But I do anticipate in 2021, I would think we'll start to see a flurry of these. But, time will tell.
Thank you. While we wait, I encourage callers to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Telefora on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Telefora calls you may have missed, as well as on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. It looks like the caller queue is still empty. Professor, do you have other comments you would like to make on the decision today?
No, I don't think so. Like I said, this it won't really disrupt the status quo. I think states that have bound their electors, now it's been tested. Now they know they can bind them. States that don't have them on the books, thought it was either unimportant or that it was sort of a low risk. Maybe there are going to be efforts in 2020 to sort of, sow some of the chaos that was proposed in 2016. But I think this is going to really clamp down on that in some of these jurisdictions that have these rules, right? These rules are going to be deemed enforceable, and therefore you've significantly reduced the number of jurisdictions where you could sort of persuade electors to vote for someone else. And then again, I think that there's going to be a movement in the state legislature. So the interesting question to me is to see how many state legislatures, you know, will make changes to their statutes and how quickly. And then, you know, the reasons why some states might choose not to, right? If they value this independent discretion. But yeah, time will tell.
It looks like the caller queue is still wide open. Professor, in the original Washington case, there was one dissenter, but the Supreme Court today unanimously affirmed the decision. Was there any reference to that one dissenter's points in the court's opinion?
No, I don't think, not that I saw, and I think they also didn't spend a lot of time examining the Tenth Circuit's reasoning either, even though the Tenth Circuit, by a 2-1 vote, concluded that the state did have or did not have the power to replace the elector. So they didn't spend a lot of time sort of critiquing that judgment or spending time focusing on what the lower court opinions had said. You know, in the Tenth Circuit, they made a lot of the elector's arguments in terms of the language used of elector, vote, ballot to suggest discretion. The Supreme Court here, you know, didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about the Tenth Circuit opinion. And again, as I mentioned, said, well, just the fact that you use those terms doesn't necessarily require independent choice. We can use those terms in ways that commonly suggest the act of voting or casting a ballot without sort of independent choice. So I think that, you know, as the Supreme Court is inclined to do, perhaps, you know, engage in its own reasoning without a whole lot of sort of express engagement with the lower court decisions looking at it. You know, another thing is maybe part of it because it's unanimous. You know, it's a pretty easy read. It's a relatively short opinion. I mean, not too short. It's about 20 pages, I think. And part of that is because I think that this opinion was issued in May or the argument was in May. And so they had a pretty short turnaround time to get an opinion out, but also it was unanimous. And I think the court sort of readily just sort of saying, this is a decision that's longstanding history. We're not going to sort of disrupt the status quo or settle expectations. And so it's a pretty straightforward read from Justice Kagan here.
Perfect. We have two callers in the queue, so let's go to them now.
Hello, gentlemen. Is there anything in this decision that might be interpreted as authority for a court to order an elector to vote according to his pledge, even in a state that doesn't have a statute on the books requiring it?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a great question. I don't think so, at least from my first read, although maybe a second or third read will lead differently. So the thought is this is really a question of state discretion and what the state chooses to do. And the court emphasized, look, if states want to have faithless electors or independent actors as electors, they've done so in the past. There was a fight in Congress in 1968 about whether to count that vote. They did count it, in part because the state law didn't prohibit them from doing so. And so I think the thought was that, you know, this is sort of a question of state power and therefore no problem. You know, an interesting, more advanced kind of question would be to think, look, the contemporary ballot lists Donald Trump or Joe Biden, and it doesn't list their electors. And when you vote, there's this expectation of voters that when you're voting for those candidates, you're voting for those candidates, even if you're indirectly doing so through the electors. And there was a brief in this case from Professor Bob Bennett at Northwestern talking about how, you know, ballot structure today, you know, would sort of give these expectations to the voters, and it would be sort of unfair, or we'd have to at least redesign the ballot if they weren't able to rely sort of adequately on those expectations. So I think that's a different kind of argument to suggest that somehow the state's power over the ballot and the decision to list just the names but not the electors then might suggest that electors have to, even in the absence of state requirement vote for a particular candidate. So, but I don't think that's something that comes out of this opinion. I think that's a more complicated argument to make. Again, the majority seems to suggest it's okay for electors to cast faithless votes if they want to, but it really is a question of state discretion, right? And this was a question of whether the state can add this requirement. Whether or not electors are compelled to do so, I think would be a bridge too far for some of the justices, but I don't know. I would have to think about the context in which those kinds of claims might arise.
Thank you very much.
Let's now go to the next question.
Hi. So the comment about state legislators affecting or regulating the electors made me wonder, how is this going to play with emergency changes being made to elections in response to coronavirus? Obviously, with regards to the electors, there's been at least one, I think, joked suggestion that state legislatures would just pick them this year. But there's obviously other changes that are going to happen as well. So how does this relate to that?
Yeah, I mean, in the event that state legislatures are already thinking about kind of omnibus election law changes to the fall, if they're thinking about one-time or long-standing changes to absentee ballot rules, absentee ballot applications, you know, extended early voting, rules about postmarking ballots and counting them, you know, all kinds of things like that, signature gathering requirements for independent candidates. To the extent that state legislatures are thinking about those, and you know, some state legislatures have been passing such statutes in the last couple of months. So not everyone's gone. To the extent that state legislatures are thinking about that, to me, this seems like a kind of natural fit to sort of roll in with some of the election law related coronavirus concerns about elections. To the extent that legislatures are thinking about it, again, you have a sort of ready-made statute from the Uniform Law Commission. You have sort of the recognition that states want to reduce uncertainty, reduce anxiety in voters thinking about the 2020 election. And again, it doesn't have a sharp partisan valence, unlike some of these other things, which absentee voting, vote by mail seems to have drawn some partisan scrutiny and maybe has a higher partisan valence. So I think. It's right to think that if state legislatures are already thinking about updating their election codes in 2020, then this is something else that they're gonna also throw in there. You know, there have been a lot of changes that have happened in voting that have been driven by either executive order, by Secretary of State discretion based on existing discretion in the books, or by federal courts sort of reviewing statutes under kind of a balancing test of the freedom of association under the Constitution. I don't think in any of those domains you're going to have the authority to sort of bind the legislatures, and for good reason, because I think the legislature is given the power under Article 2 to direct the manner of appointment, as you point out, if they want to appoint it themselves, although that also seems extremely unlikely. So I think rolling in additional rules regulating the discretion of electors would be a sort of natural addition to the coronavirus updated statutes. But again, it's sort of just a guess, thinking about how thinking about the closing window of time and whether or not legislatures are interested in sort of adding one more piece, or how controversial that would be. Maybe it won't be controversial, maybe because you've got a Uniform Law Commission statute, it's going to be a lot easier, but we shall see.
Professor, is there anything you want to conclude on before we finish up today?
No, I don't. I mean, I'll just mention sort of historically, there is this sort of mismatch between theory and practice in some ways when we talk about the Electoral College. You know, we have sort of these theories of electoral independence, and then we have the practice where they have very rarely exercised that. And you have sort of the theory of electoral independence where they're going to vote for sort of the best available candidates, with the practice of 2016, which was, John Kasich had said, "I'm not running for president," after he dropped out, and Colin Powell was certainly not running for president. So it's sort of an interesting comparison to think about what we might, in the best universe, anticipate the Electoral College to do, and the way it sort of actually operated. So, this is an opinion, and I think Justice Kavanaugh, during an oral argument, sort of raised expressly the idea of the do no chaos kind of theory of judging, which is sort of maintaining the status quo and sort of settled expectations. But I do think, this is going to result in some changes. As I mentioned, I do think state legislatures are going to react and respond and enact more such statutes. Now, again, practically speaking, because there have been so few faithless electors, it's going to be hardly a blip on the radar for your average voter who has sort of reliably voted and seen their electors follow through. But it is a change, and it is something that we'll see in the years ahead.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.